Hello and welcome to The Great Game, an Australian mega game podcast. We've got an awesome episode for you today, all about crunch in mega games. What is crunch? What is a mega game? What are we all doing here? What's going on? It's all in this episode. You will find out every answer. Quick announcements. My video game, my visual novel, The Thief, The Witch, The Toad, and The Mushroom is released now. It's live on Steam. It is completely free, so you should check it out and download it and play it. It's a lovely, charming, yet slightly sinister folktale visual novel inspired by my love of old choose-your-own-adventure books and old fairy tales and all that kind of thing. So if that sounds like your vibe, definitely check it out. First Contact, Melbourne. The tickets for this one are 75% sold out. This is the massive mega game of Alien First Contact on Earth, with, I believe, 200 players. I'll be down there helping run the game, so tickets may have already sold out by the time you hear this episode, but if they haven't, you should definitely check it out. And finally, look, there's huge amounts of minigames happening this year, which is fantastic, so we're not going to shout out them all, but if you are interested, you should go to megagameassembly.com and check out their calendar, where you can see basically most all mega games that are happening around the globe, and check out any that are in your area. And without further ado, on to the episode. So today we're talking about crunch in mega games and crunch versus rules light mega game. What does it mean? What is crunch in a mega game? Let's start out, Pat. What does the word crunch mean to you? What concept is that?
Well, I was much more confident in my answer before we had a pre-chat before the show, but I suppose if I go back before we had that talk. I would have said that crunch is complexity. It's how many rules that you need to learn, and you know, if we hearken to board games, where I think that terminology comes from, or even tabletop role-playing games, I think it's a good measure of crunch is how often you need to check the rules on things, because there's numbers and modifiers and that kind of thing. How would you define it?
Absolutely, I think that's part of it. And so I believe the word comes from number crunching, as in like how much maths do you have to do when you try to do something. And so that's kind of initially that complexity, or having lots of maths and lots of numbers and lots of detailed calculations you need to do before you want to take a move in a mega game. That is part of, I think, what makes it a crunchy mega game. But I would also move it away from that. I think the complexity of the decisions you have to make and the amount of crunching you have to do, as in thinking through your options and how many different things you have to consider, can make a game crunchy, even if it has a smaller amount of rules. I think there are quite a few board games out there that when you read the rule book, it's pretty slim, but you pretty quickly realize when you get into it that the way these rules interact and the cards and the different ways you have to manage the economy of different resources all makes it like you're sitting there and your brain is burning as you try to figure out how to do things in anything in this game. I would also label that like a crunchy experience.
Yeah.
What do you think? Is that fair, or am I broadening it too much?
I think that's fair. I think that it is about mathematics and doing meta work in the background. It can be around decisions as well, but I think that there is a decent slice of meta in crunch. Figuring out how to achieve the best outcome, not necessarily in the fictional world, or perhaps the historic reality that the mega game's set in, but more in the game's mechanics. However, I don't think often crunch is used on a scale, and there's usually like this sliding scale of crunchiness versus role-playing or lightness. And I think that That scale can maybe be a bit dangerous because I don't think crunch necessarily translates to complexity or complication, like you're saying. I think it is more about the amount of effort that the rules are going to inspire.
Definitely. And I think, so normally crunch, when people talk about it, it's opposed to fluff, which is, fluff is like the story, the flavor, you know, the flavor text on the cards. And it's normally, the way people talk about it, it's as if fluff is the stuff that you don't really worry about, that doesn't matter. And I don't think that's the case for mega games, obviously, right? I don't think it's a situation where we have the airy fairy story side of things that doesn't have any crunch and that is just flavor text, and then we have the hardcore mechanics. I think it's all intermeshed, right? The mechanics and the flavor and the story are all the one thing. They're all working towards the same goal. And when you're doing something, usually there isn't an explicit, like, I'm doing this because I want to get the most victory conditions and I want to get the most victory points and I want to win the game. You're doing it ultimately for story reasons, because you care about your personal goals, or you care about something, you know, you care about making sure that your nation is doing well. Like, you're doing things like, for narrative reasons, and you're often doing, like, very narrative-focused things. So I guess, I think that split that is normally talked about is not a thing in mega games as much.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. And I think when we talk about crunchiness of rules, it often takes us back to board games or, like I said, role-playing games. And I think that the definition, or at least the degree of crunchiness, and what makes something crunchy or high crunch, I think we're going to get sick of saying crunch in this episode. It's already starting to lose a bit of meaning for me. But I think when we say things are crunchy in the mega game space, that could actually mean something quite different to board games or, you know, even video games. There are definitely some crunchy video games out there that are basically a very pretty spreadsheet that you are playing with some nice graphics. And I think, I think it can have a different, maybe not a fully different definition, but definitely different intensity when it comes to mega games. I think that mega games and the experience players have in them can slide into the world of crunch much sooner than in board games.
Definitely. I think so, yeah. Let's talk about what crunch means when you're talking about a mega game, because I think the way that you think about crunch in a role-playing game or a board game or anything like that, if you said this is a really crunchy mega game, that means a very different thing to me. And part of that is just because of the level of complexity that a mega game can reasonably have is actually kind of so much lower than any most board games or role-playing games, I guess, just because of the amount of players, the amount of stuff that's going on, the fact that most people are going to be, a lot of the player base who comes to a mega game are going to be new to the situation. The amount of rules that are facing each individual player has to be pretty low. Like, I would say God Emperor is a very crunchy mega game, and each individual section of God Emperor has maybe like 3 or 4 pages of rules, which is, in a board game context, that would be very small. In a mega game context, 3 or 4 pages of rules is pretty hefty, I would say. And so I compare a thing like, a board game like Oath, which is a lovely game that I enjoy, it only has 12 pages of rules, but the amount of decisions you have to make when you sit down to your turn, the amount of things you do on your turn, the amount of actions you take, you could be taking like 5 different actions and different, which have different costs, and like really crunch it. You could sit there for like 5-10 minutes, like really crunching through all these possibilities and what you're going to do and do things. That would not work in a mega game at all. You cannot have someone sit there and take their turn for 10 minutes and then go, okay, now it's the next person's turn, obviously, right? that is completely unfeasible. You can't do that for 50 people. Crunchy for a mega game, I think, it's probably more about the interactions that you have to consider with your little bit of the rules and how those interact with everyone else around the game. And like, yeah, basically what I'm saying is the complexity scale for a high crunch mega game is way, way lower than most other mediums, I guess.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think that it's important as well to note that a lot of the time, not all the time, but a lot of the time, vast majority of the time, I'd say, when you're playing board games, all players have the same level of crunchiness and complexity to what they're doing and how they're interacting with the game. Whereas in mega games, nearly in every game that I've played, even those that don't have explicit roles like God Emperor, there is more choice around what you as an individual are doing in the game. And there are some parts of the game which might dominate someone's entire day that are way less crunchy than other parts. So, for example, there is the iconic Watch the Skies that we have to bring up every episode if we can. and in that original game, as it was originally published, the science game had almost nothing mechanical, you know, no heavy mechanics to it at all. It was a very role-play, creative game. And so players who were in there would probably argue that that is not a crunchy game at all for a mega game, because their experience would not have them, you know, doing maths, being too strategic other than in the role play relationship side of the game. Much sort of contrasted to other members of their team who would have a very different day. For example, the people who are going to the war map as the generals, they've got a lot of dice to roll, numbers and odds to consider. I still don't think it's a particularly crunchy game, but it is crunchier. So I think it's important for us to distinguish that some games, they may feel rules heavy or crunchy or complex, but it also depends on the player role that they're fulfilling in that game as to what their experience ends up being. I suppose categorization of a game being crunchy is different to the player experience. In many cases, it's not always going to be the same experience for everyone.
So that is one of the strengths of mega games, I think, is that you can make different sections of the game that cater to different players and what they're looking for, right? So you can have the court or the UN or the talkie. You can have a talkie council game that can be very rules light and easy and approachable. And ultimately, in that side of the game, you're just talking to people and trying to do things with very small amount of rules. And then over on the other side of the room, you can have the big map, and you can have all the little miniatures and all the dice and all these crunchy strategic decisions going on. And both of those games can feed into each other, and they can both cater to the player who wants that experience. So a mega game can have... Yeah, and I think I've had a lot of people who have said that I think that's kind of critical for a mega game. I don't quite agree. I think it's okay to have a more rules-light mega game that doesn't have a crunchy component to it. But it is like a really nice strength of mega games that you can have that if you want to. You can have like both of these sections that cater to two different, very different types of players, and they can both feed into each other and all be in the same ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people designing games strive for that. It's a recognized strength of the product, and I think in a lot of games there is the obligatory kind of light role play area. If there's the crunchier area, there's the politicking sort of resourcing kind of metagame part of the game. I agree that I don't think it is necessary, but it does come down to how the game is sold or handed over to an audience. I think something that we talk about a lot in the design space and probably in previous episodes as well is about making sure that the audience of a game understands what they're getting into, setting their expectations correctly. And I think it's okay for a game to be very light, but it's important that everyone coming along, regardless of their role, understands that, and nobody is coming along expecting a war game or something. very recent example of that is The Generalism of His Dead that we've talked about a few times on the podcast, and we ran in Sydney recently. There are roles in that game that sound like they are going to be wargamey roles, like the general of the army or the admiral of the navy. But it's pretty explicitly made clear in the rules and also in everything that we did to sort of brief people on their roles that those are still role-playing roles. The mechanics of the game are very light. There's very little crunch. The decision-making around what to do in those military roles and many of the other roles in the game is very low intensity. The complexity of those decisions comes from politics in the game, but the decisions themselves and the actions that you take are basically very simple, low option worker placement. You know, you put this thing there and then it does a thing and that is it. And it's in the grand scheme, it's pretty low effort and low impact. As a whole, all of those little actions add up, but individual players don't have to think about lots of numbers and complexity. So I think that, it's important that in that game, we made sure that people didn't think that they were going to be coming to push little soldiers around a map and roll dice and do that kind of thing, which I think everyone understood. And in fact, we did have a new player come to the first run of Generalissimo who, during casting, actually outed themselves as a wargamer and said, you know, they're interested in trying this new thing. And their review of the game was glowing because it was exactly what they're after. It was different to what they're used to. It was still enjoyable. It still had a lot of interesting decisions to make. And I think it sort of goes back to something that we've talked about a few times, but I remember specifically with Rob talking about the mega game survey, that there are a lot of mega gamers out there who are really into things like board games, but that doesn't mean that when they come to a mega game, they want a board game. It just happens that they, you know, their interests overlap. But when they come to a mega game, most people want something else. And it's really good that in this case, this person got that. I'm going on a tangent, but yeah, set expectations about, about crunch.
I'm so glad they had a great experience. That's awesome. Yeah, I think we're seeing a few of those mega games like that. I think Deep Haven is like that as well, which is a fantasy mega game about dwarves. And it's deliberately very role play and rules light. And there is, to my understanding, there's no section where, you know, the dwarves go and put people on a map and attack each other. That is not part of the game. It is purely about these, like improv-y, rules light kind of situations. Which I really love. I think I'm excited to try more of these, like, very unified experiences, I guess, where it's like everyone in the mega game is getting this similar, maybe some of them are a little more crunchy than others, but mostly you're all going there for that same style of experience. I think, yeah, talking about your thing about board games and expectations, I feel like my vibe of the design trends and where this is swung over time is, I'm interested to see if you agree with this, but my vibe is that after the Shut Up and Sit Down video kind of exploded mega games into the wider scene, I think that brought a lot of board gamers in, like us included, obviously. But yeah. I think it kind of maybe did give people the vibe that mega games are board games with a little sprinkle of role playing attached to them. Just because I think if you watch the video, they do where they play Watch the Skies for the first time, which is for those who aren't aware, is the big inciting incident of all of this for most of us. If you watch the video, they approach it like a board game because they are a board game site, right? And then about halfway through, they're like, oh, wait, hold on a second. This spy unit, it can actually do anything I want. I don't have to just like put it on the map and roll dice and follow the rules. I can send this spy to do wacky things. I could send it to, assassinate the president, like whatever. It's wide open. It's like, whoa. And it's like this big moment in the video where they discover that it isn't just a big board game, which is great. But I do think when I look at a lot of the earlier designs or a lot of the early vibes, or at least just my impression of it, a lot of it was very kind of like, okay, let's make a board game with a sprinkle of role playing and a soupçon of narrative stuff going on. Mm. Like more crunchy mega games, I guess, which are totally great and fine, by the way. But that's my vibe of what the initial a lot of the initial mega games, like coming out of America and areas like that, were more focused on. Example, you have Aegean's Conquest, which was a while after the video, actually, but which is based on Game of Thrones, and it is the only mega game I know of that has a victory condition and victory points, and someone wins the game, which are all very, you know, crunchy, board gamey things to be thinking of. And then over time, my vibe is that we've had a bit of a swing in the opposite direction, where things are going a bit more rules light, and we're seeing more games like The Generalissimo is Dead or Deep Haven that are more focused on, like, let's have a whole mega game that is just roleplay focused and just rules light and isn't very crunchy. What do you think? Do you think that's fair or?
No, I think that you're right. I think that video and Watch the Skies introduced a whole bunch of people. And so that was their basis. And I mean, like I've said on the podcast before, it was the first two games that I designed after being exposed to Watch the Skies. They were very similar to Watch the Skies. They had the same kind of composition of having a council and a map and that kind of thing. I would only add to that perhaps that cycle that we are now in, where 2014, lots of people learned about Watch the Skies, they all started playing it, then a new sort of generation of designers started creating mega games. And then over the coming decade, which it's been a decade, those designers started to steer further into, you know, the depths of role play, overlapping with LARP, looking at social or political simulation more than the big board game side of things. I feel like that cycle has happened once before, and I would suggest that were we talking to some of the original mega game designers, you know, going back to the 80s or even, perhaps even earlier, when mega gaming was born out of wargaming, as I understand it. I imagine they have gone through that cycle already, and, you know, before it became quite a widespread, popularized thing, they had probably already made the jump to some very rules-light political or social games. For example, I haven't played it, but I've read some of the rules. The Washington Conference, which was a mega game makers, I think Dave Boundy might be the author of that. I apologize if I got it wrong. That one, that's not a particularly new game, but it was very, very, it looks very light, very low crunch, high political role play. And so I totally agree with you. And I think that this new tranche of mega game designers and players are now reaching the curve where we're like, we don't have to actually make a big board game here. We need to do what Johan does and put a bit of paper on the floor and say, guys, that's the Event Horizon. What are you going to do about it? I love that quote, and I love that example, and I think that, yeah, we've made it round. I don't think it's just happened. I think it's been happening for a little while now, but I think those games are getting more popular over the last, I don't know, sort of post COVID, I suppose, which is exciting, because I agree, I'm much more on board with them than I was 5 years ago.
I completely agree. Yeah, we're all doomed to repeat history over and over, I guess. But yeah, yeah. I do think when you play Watch the Skies for the first time, if you haven't actually played it, I think at least when I played it first, I was actually surprised by how rules light and how narrative it is. I guess getting the impression from, you know, getting this initial video from a bunch of people who are approaching it from a board gamer's perspective, when you kind of get into the rules, you're like, okay, what does this unit do? And the answer is, it does whatever the moderator thinks makes sense, right? Like, it is a lot of stuff like that, which is very, very much like, it's narrative, it's rules light, it is, you know, it obviously it does have this element where you're moving troops around the map, but ultimately, like, the core of the game is the story. Like, that's what it all kind of falls back on. Like, the mechanics are there to supplant things, but ultimately all they're doing is, like, yeah, conveying a story. So I think, yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if at some stage we'll have another I wonder if this will keep going in cycles, and next we'll have just a bunch of ultra mega heavy mega games of Ultra Crunch or something. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, in the 2030s, we will have high crunch war games with very light role playing, but they'll all be done with the Oculus or whatever that new thing is.
Oh, true. You know, true. I mean, that would be a way to offload a lot of the crunch. Is you just have that kind of everyone comes in wearing it,
and they will die. They will die on a hill, arguing that it is not a video game. I could picture it now. I'm interested because I think there will be ebbs and flows. I think already in the communities there are people who prefer certain things. This is what brings me back to audiences and what they're after. We know that with the Generalissimo is Dead as our first game this year, we've got some regular players who came to both of our games last year and many of our games before COVID shut everything down for a little while. And they did not come to the Generalissimo is Dead because it was clearly sort of articulated that it's not the kind of game for them. Thematically, perhaps, but also mechanically, they want to do some dice and they want to do some deck building and they want to do some board gamey stuff. And they want to be able to... we've got players in Sydney who are very motivated by breaking the game, which is fine.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm all for that. And they are they're an audience, and we do need to try to cater to them, I think, if we're trying to grow the hobby and make diverse games. But in this case, they knew this wasn't for them, and it's probably a right decision because there isn't a lot of crunch in that game. The next game that we run in Sydney is going to be... it's going to be one of those diverse ones, I suppose, where there are going to be some roles which feel like they're from a very light, almost LARPy role-play political game. And there's going to be other roles that are going to be all about numbers and optimizing and resource management and moving units on a map. So I think we'll have a mixture of players at that game, and hopefully we'll be able to match people correctly to those roles.
Yeah, definitely. And I think having a mixture and a diversity of mega games is really wonderful. That's what you want, right? Like, you don't want it to be completely dominated by one specific type of game. It's great to have a bunch of different things. And that's definitely, in the mega game I'm working on at the moment is definitely that rules light, role play. There's no big map. There's no dice rolling. There's no crunchy strategic resource management. It is very much in that vein. So I'm very excited to see how it goes over with people here, and hopefully it goes well. I think when designing, I want to talk about what's the best way to design crunch into a mega game. I think we've established and we talked about, like, you can't just take a crunchy board game or a crunchy role-playing game and put it in a mega game, because it won't work. If you have a role-playing game, you're like, I can do three different things on my turn, like in Pathfinder 2nd Edition, and you're like, I've got all these crunchy decisions about these three actions. What do I want to do? Well, it's not going to work in a mega game. There is no time for that. There's no time for each player to take a turn and to do something quite crunchy with their turn. That's obviously not going to work at all. I think the type of crunch that does work is about interacting between different systems. So I think in God Emperor, I would say a lot of the crunch in that game comes from the fact that you have the three different sections of the game. You can go to any of these three sections and they interact in quite intricate ways that you often have to plan ahead. Like, if you want to, for example, the court rotates around the map, if you want to do something to that court where you're going to attack it or you're going to use a scheme to do something with it, you're going to have to set that up multiple turns in advance, and then you're also going to want to do things in different areas of the game, and those interactions are really complicated and crunchy. Even though when you actually go to the court, the things you're doing are pretty simple. You're just voting on something in a reasonably simple way. But I think that's probably the ideal type of crunch for a mega game. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that that is definitely a sure way to insert crunch, I suppose. I think adding that strategic layer and adding complexity to the decision's outcomes. I think in God Emperor, for example, to stick to it, the court indeed can be quite light. However, once you connect it to the other parts of the game, some of the decisions made there, some they may need a lot of communication attached to them to do them effectively, and also planning if there are decisions being made there which are going to impact another part of the game. Likewise, for the underground, both of those can have sweeping impacts on the map game, the big war game, but not instantly often. So they need to be sort of coordinated and planned. I still feel that perhaps in the mega game space, God Emperor probably isn't the crunchiest of games. I think it's higher up there, and it's got a lot of the board game components to it, but I'm not sure it's sort of the be-all and all of crunch.
What would you say is the crunchiest mega game in your experience?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't. And my experience of playing games is far outweighed by designing them. And if I just talked about all the ones I've designed, very few people would know what I'm talking about, I suppose. I feel like so Crisis in Elysium is probably a touch point on the international stage that I have played. It felt very crunchy. It was interesting because there are a lot of roles in that game that are doing the same thing, even on the same team. So many teams would be sending people to three different maps and playing out a kind of resource management, worker placement, war game. So those three people were doing all the same thing in different places, but the experience and the complexity of the decisions they needed to make were very different based on the politics of that particular map. I found that game quite crunchy because there were a lot of there was a bit of maths in the combat to do. There was a lot of decisions to make. It was when it comes to worker placement, that was a very complex game because there was a lot of politics, history, and strategy overlaid the simple sort of worker placement unit moving game. But also, that because of my experience in being in that role, I didn't get to be exposed to the council game, which was there as the obligatory sort of role play part of the game. I'm not sure how that played out. I can only assume that it was also quite light, you know, as council games often are. So I think that's one of the crunchiest that I've played. Also, I played Den of Wolves in that. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of custom parts, I think is interesting. It adds a lot of complexity to the game because each team, most teams have their own little thing that they're getting up to. That's like a variation of the main rules. That being said, as the player experience, I was in a leadership role, so I needed to make decisions, but the complexity of making those decisions was mostly based on what other players told me. So I wouldn't say it was a crunchy game for me. I think the people who were moving lots of pieces around the world and responsible for the spaceship fights when they happened, rolling dice and that kind of thing, or maybe it was cards in that game, I'm not sure. That may have been a much more crunchy experience, but I found that game pretty... It had a lot of board gaming moving parts, but the complexity was quite low in that I would say it's not particularly crunchy.
That makes sense.
It's almost like we can define anything as anything and get away with it.
Very true. I think, another interesting thing about crunch in mega games is that we do have this control team, which you can offload a lot of the crunch to. In the same way that in a video game, you know, you can do an action and then there can be some really heavy, crunchy mathematics behind that decision, but ultimately all you see is either the action succeeded or it failed. Like, you don't need to actually directly care about the numbers or the maths or the complexity of that decision. You can just do something. So you can definitely have mega games where, you know, let's say I set make an order to my troops and control carries that out, And that can be pretty complex. There can be lots of different calculations about morale, and especially in the wargaming, more wargaming style of games, there can be lots of different complex factors that decide how that troop does in that battle. But none of that necessarily has to be player facing. So we can have a game that is kind of not exactly rules light, but where the player facing rules are very rules light, and the crunch is offloaded to the control team. Now, the downside of that obviously is that you don't necessarily want your poor control team to have to be crunching all this stuff all the time and to be completely overworked, but it does potentially allow you to have those really interesting decisions while still keeping things fairly simple for the player facing side of things.
And I think, so The Generalissimo is Dead is a good example of this, because that game is really light. There's not a lot to it, and there's not a lot for you to worry about as a player as far as weighing up numbers and stats and that kind of thing. But for the team running it, it was very, very much a complex, crunchy experience, at least for some of us, because there were a lot, basically every turn in that game, there's a whole bunch of pluses and minuses that all need to be recorded from different parts of the physical game area and then added up and then applied to a total, and having these stats that are written up on the wall changing at all times. So it does become quite a calculator Excel game for some of the people running it, which I think is important to factor in. Something that I am keen to pursue more and more with design is having rules whereby the facilitators do less and less as the game goes on, and the experience is slowly handed over to the players just naturally. I think we did manage to do that quite a bit with The Generalissimo is Dead. Some of that's written into the rules. And then also with the ARC that we read last year, designed by Leon down at Melbourne, in Melbourne. It also is very tightly designed in its mechanics, so that sort of midway through the game, the players that are running the little mini games of that. I think God Emperor is probably the same as well, where I definitely know the second time we ran it, I think the underground started to run itself a little bit. So that's, I mean, that's tangential, I suppose. It's just something I'd like to pursue and think that it leads to a good experience for the people running the game if they can start to ease back as the game goes on. It also gives players a lot of control and the feeling of progress, I suppose, if they're able to pick things up and run with it and sort of make what they're doing each turn more efficient. But yeah, I think that a lot of the time, design is usually going to heap more of the crunch and complexity to the people running it. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but it's definitely worth balancing, because it is vital to me that the facilitators running these games are enjoying themselves as well. It's almost like playing a different version of the same mega game. So if you just heap them with spreadsheets all day and that's all they do, then I think that can be a problem, even if it leads to a good player experience.
Definitely. It's one of those things. I think there's, I know there are mega games out there where, for example, the map is actually hidden from the players, and you give your orders to the control team, they go carry it out, and then they report back what happens. So you have this really, which I think I'd love to try something like that, because it does give you this really interesting fog of war and confusion, and you have to communicate to people to figure out what's going on in different areas of the map. So I think there are lots of ways to use that as a really great tool, but in my own designs, I have really leaned towards trying to make the control team do less and less, and more of it to be on the players, just because, like, you know, ultimately, if something needs to be carried out by a control team person, then you've got this bottleneck that the actions have to go through, right? Where all these actions have to go through, you know, let's say you have five people in a particular section and one control team member, that's already a pretty decent ratio of the amount of control team members you're needing. But that means all the decisions those five people make all need to go through this one person before they can actually do anything, and that can easily lead to that one person, the control team member, being super overworked and having to do a ton of stuff, and a lot of the five players kind of waiting around for stuff to be resolved and not having a lot of things to do. So the ideal situation is that the control team member can sit back and have a cup of tea and maybe chime in to clarify things or help or to resolve narrative things. But mostly the five players are just interacting with each other and doing things, and they're able to completely carry out the rules on their own. That's definitely the way I've kind of vibed and gone towards in my design trajectory.
Yeah, I think it's common in a lot of recently designed games that I've seen. Seems like that is the way to go. And I think it happens a bit organically as well. If a game has a certain rhythm in a loop, it does happen naturally as players become comfortable with it all. I'm curious, Jack, what your thoughts are, having gone through all of this and doing the comparison to board games. And we also talked about sort of going back, devolving from mega games back to sort of wargaming world. What do you think about the level of crunch, and can it push a game? At what point does a mega game no longer become a mega game because it is too crunchy?
At what point does it become a board game?
Yeah.
I think I'm not sure if it ever... it's interesting. I know there is... So there is a mega board game, Vampire the Masquerade Blood Feud, which is just by Ben Canalos, I believe is how you pronounce his name. But it is a game that is purely... it's inspired by mega games, and you run it, I think it's maybe about 20 players, but you run it purely as a board game. So you have like a little council game and a little map game and things like that. But there's no role-playing element. There's no ability to talk to a control person and do some wacky narrative thing. You're just purely playing it as a board game. I don't know where the dividing line is. I'm always in terms of definitions, I'm not one to get too tied up in things. I think any, you know, if you say it's a mega game, it's a mega game. Like, I'm not the one who's going to go, wait, this isn't a mega game anymore, get out of here. You know, that's not the vibe, I think. I haven't played Vampire the Masquerade Blood Feud, but I do really like that idea, and I would love to try a board game like that. I think there are a lot of interesting things about the communication of information and the way that mega games handle like bureaucracy and trying to coordinate with your team as they all go to different areas that are fun, even if it is a pure board game, even if you are moving troops around the map and rolling dice and there's no role-playing element. I think that's still interesting, and I would love to see more board games take inspiration from that. I don't think there's a clear, fine dividing line, personally. What about you?
No, you passed the test.
good. I get to remain on the podcast for now.
I'm trying to sneakily pull us into what is a mega game, but I know that we're not going to...
Not again.
I know that we made that mistake. No, I agree. I think, you know, a lot of this stuff ends up coming back to audience expectations and how you influence those. I think a key thing, talking about board games versus role-playing games, for example, or crunch versus role-play, or anything that sort of strays into role-play, is something I've sort of promoted quite a bit over the years. An article, a Sydney Mega Gamer friend of ours, Tony, wrote, I think it's on the Mega Game Assembly, we will post a link to it, where he talks about how his experience in mega games is not role-playing per se, but it is more what he called play believe, which is, you know, not taking on a particular persona, but becoming yourself or a version of yourself in a particular role or instance or, scenario. And I think that is something to be very wary of, I suppose, in designing games. You could have a mega game that is very crunchy and feels a lot like a war game or a big board game, and it has a very light role play elements. But I think you still sort of get the tick of a mega game against it if the players are challenged to act or make decisions in a different way than if they were hanging out on the weekend playing Twilight Imperium or something like that. which is where they are imbuing some kind of pretend of how they usually act, I suppose. It kind of comes down to that general idea that there's an agreement when you're playing games. I've heard it talked about a lot in the board game space, where everyone is agreeing that the rules are actually the rules, and they're going to play out a game based on those rules, and the fun disappears if anyone sort of just says, well, I'm going to do whatever I want because I don't agree with the rules. Mega games are similar to that, slightly different, I suppose, because in a lot of designs, we encourage people to sort of try to break those rules, but they are still all agreeing in some fiction that there is a setting, there is a scenario, and that people are going to be expected to behave in a certain way. And it doesn't mean that they are going to take on the persona of someone new, but it means that they are going to be having these influences that are designed into the game, helping them make decisions. So I think that, you can get quite close to a board game space with your maker game design. But I think that if you've still got something that drives player decision making that is not meta, which is not based on numbers, but is something based on an agreed fiction or an agreed setting, then I think that you are well into the maker game space, no matter how crunchy the components might feel.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of gets to one of the advantages of crunch, is that it is very clear, like you're saying with board games, is that the rules are the rules. You know what the rules are. You know how to do things. You know how to affect actions. It means that your interactions with the game and how you do things and the level of agency you have is very clear and defined. And the more you get into rules light, and the more you get into like more improv-y narrative areas, the more I think you need to be careful to define things as to like how players are actually interacting with the game and how they have agency. Because it is easy if it's like, let's imagine a totally, completely freeform mega game that's just anything goes. Number one, it would be easy for each moderator or each control person to have totally different visions of how an action could happen, right? Like I could go to one control member and say, I want to assassinate someone, and they could say, that's great. Or I could go to another one and they could say, no, you're not allowed to assassinate anyone. That's not part of this game. You know, I could get different answers from every control person, right? In a crunchy experience or a board gaming experience, it's like, no, here are the assassination rules. Here's how it works. Here's what you do. You use these resources. There is a lot of comfort in that. And I think when applied well, that is something that crunch can do, is that ideally, it makes sure that everyone has agency and that everyone knows what's going on. That if they get assassinated, they know what happened. They're like, oh, I should have put more resources in the defense action, you know, whatever, right? Like, they know what happened. They know it was mechanical. They know it was their fault that they got assassinated. Whereas if it's free, airy-fairy, narrative-focused, role-play-focused, you need to be careful to define what the boundaries of that are to some extent, or like what the guidelines are to some extent, to avoid situations where, you know, a player gets assassinated out of nowhere. They're like, oh, I didn't even realize that was like part of the game. I didn't know how assassinations worked because it's purely a roleplay thing. And now I've kind of been taken out, or this terrible thing has happened to me. And I don't feel very good about that because I don't feel like there was any structure or any things there to let me know that this was part of the game. And I think, so I think what a lot of role-playing games do nowadays, like Apocalypse World, for example, which is the game that is, I believe Deep Haven is heavily inspired by this. In Apocalypse World, it is very improv-y, it's very rules-light, it's very rules role-play-y. But the way it handles that is very specific and very directed and very controlled. So for example, when you roll dice, you can roll a complication. You can succeed the action you were trying to do, but you get a complication. And there is, instead of just being the complication being the GM does whatever they want, there's like a very specific list of GM moves that you can do when someone suffers a complication. So it's like, you can separate the party, you can take away their stuff. You can offer an opportunity with a cost. You know, there's a very specific list, and the rules are very specific of, like, these are the only things you can do in this situation. You're not allowed to go off script and do whatever you want. Like, here are the 14 things that, you know, a consequence or a complication could be. And that helps it be, like, even though it is rules light and roleplay focused, you do get a good understanding of what the outcomes are and what kind of consequences you can expect. So I think that kind of framework is really valuable to have, even in a very roleplay focused mega game. Because I think, you know, if you're playing a very roleplay focused D&D session and you've got one GM, then you know that GM, you know how they think, you're all friends with them, ideally. So it's pretty easy, even if you don't have strict rules set out, or even if it is completely up in the air and it's completely rules light, you probably know that things are going to be okay, and that you know what kind of actions are going to happen because you have this close personal connection with that GM. In a mega game, you don't necessarily have that, and you also have like 10 GMs. So having like some kind of structure for a very rules light mega game, I feel like, is pretty crucial, or some set of GM principles to follow, or things like that.
Yep. No, I agree with that. And I think it's probably something that we will see more of in the mega game space, if it's not already quite out there at the moment. Like I said, my experience of playing certain games is limited, but I think that it's an interesting design method where it is light and it's role play forward, but it is also rigid, which I think helps a lot in mega games. We often, playing mega games, you don't want to say a lot of no to people's ideas. But a system like that where you can basically say yes to everything, but it's going to end up being one of these 14 things, really helps give consistency. It lets players go free with their freeform ideas, but then it gives a framework that is consistent to the people running it. I think that that's a very good sort of middle ground, and I'd like to see more of it in some mega games. I guess you could argue that some mega games have it in a less defined way. So thinking about games that are like Watch the Skies or akin to that, where players have this ability to, in Watch the Skies, the analog is special agents that you can send to do things, and they're kind of like your, I think the UK crowd would call it a wizard wheeze, which is a term that I just hate and I don't know why.
It's very British, isn't it? You have to say it in a British accent to get the full effect. Let's try a wizard wheeze, shall we?
Oh, jeez. You went there. I'm not editing that. That is going to stay.
Sorry, UK listeners.
No. They're going to love it.
Good.
But I think it's a mechanic, and it lets players go and do a thing, but it's also just like, you got to roll a die and see what happens, and there's some modifiers you can attach to it. So especially, I guess, in that case, it is similar to limiting player outputs, but not restricting their inputs. But I like the idea of it being more deliberately designed, like you were saying with Apocalypse World, where there is a list of things, and even the players know that that list of things is going to be all the things that they use. So the more mechanical-minded people can actually say, I'm going to use action 4, and this is how I want to use it. Whereas others might just come up with some crazy scheme, and then the person running the game can just say, yep, well, that's an action 12, so I'm going to go and do this thing now. I like that. Yeah. It's a really good framework to lean on. I guess I would like to see it in practice in a mega game, a full-on mega game.
Me too.
Whether or not it's got holes and whether or not it does start to feel formulaic, but I think it's promising.
I'm not sure if Deephaven, how much Deephaven uses it. I know they do have, so another thing from, I guess it's not just from Apocalypse World, but I know it from there, at least, is the idea of the player agenda and the GM agenda or GM principles, which is like, you know, the list of things is like, hey, here's the things you should do to have the most fun out of this game. Yeah. And for the GM, it's like, here's the list of principles you should follow in order to make sure everyone has the best experience in this game. I feel like having at least those is really critical, and it becomes more critical the more rules light you are, or the more role play you are, I would say. Like, you know, in a board game, you don't need that because I don't need any principles of, like, I'm just going to do whatever actions I do. And if an action isn't fun, then the board game is meant to remove that rule that allows me to do that action, right? Like, it should be that I'm literally not allowed to do anything. Well, I mean, depending on the board game, but ideally the board game is designed so that I will have fun, and we have a very strict set of rules to accomplish that. But the more you open that up and the more you say you can do anything, the more I think you need those, like, defined principles of, like, here's the things you should be thinking about in order to make sure you enjoy your experience. And I really loved the chat with the folks from Melbourne Mega Games, where they talked about having those on the back of the name tag for one of their games, which I think is a fantastic idea.
And I think that giving the players those ideas up front as a benchmark can really help, because I feel whether the mechanics behind it are crunchy or not, giving players the "you can do anything" is one sure way to lead a lot of people into decision paralysis. And I mean,
true,
or analysis paralysis. Some people like that, and I know that in many games it is designed into the game for a specific reason. But just generally, I think it's always good. You can, regardless of the crunch behind it, if people are kind of able to come up with their own ideas of anything that they'd like to do, it's great to give them some guidance. I think that we did that, you and I did that with the God Emperors in Sydney last year, where the different were given example schemes, and we've said you can come up with whichever ones you'd like, but these are some pre-written ones that sort of suit your team's, you know, vibe. And I think that's, it's a really good practice.
Definitely. It's an interesting case study because we started out, you know, first run we had a big list of example laws in the rule book that you could propose before the core. It's like, hey, here's a big list of examples. And what we found in the first run is that people kind of took that, you know, obviously the intent was you can announce, you can try any law you want, you know, you can make your own custom laws. But I think it ended up being that people were just like, oh, here are the 10 laws, or here are the 15 laws that I'm allowed to propose, right? And I'm not going to deviate from this list. And so it ended up being very, it was still fun, I think, obviously. But, it ended up being more crunchy and less roleplay, I guess, than was intended. And so we kind of fiddled that back and forth to find the right balance of it. Because it's kind of a tough thing. If you give people too much guidance, then they're like, oh, here are the only things I'm allowed to do. you need to kind of ideally give them enough to give them a springboard of like, hey, here's some stuff to generate ideas, here's some ways to role play in this rules light infinite decision space, without making it feel too much like, oh, this is the rules, these are the things, only do these things, you know.
So I suppose we should probably do some kind of summary. I'm wondering, you know, talking through this, Jack, what you think you've taken out of the question, I suppose, what is crunch when it comes to mega games, and is it good? What are your key takeaways?
I think what I've taken away from this conversation, I think the downside of crunch is that obviously it makes your game more complicated. And, you know, a lot of the people who are playing your mega game will be playing it for the first time. So it's very easy for that to overload people, or to lead to a poor experience. The upside of crunch is that it's great to have that section of the game with that crunchy element for the players who really love it. That's a really huge strength of mega games. And it allows people to opt in to the level of crunch they want to enjoy, which is really, really wonderful. And it is nice that it gives a directed. I think crunch is great when used, especially for more negative actions that affect other players, because it gives you these defined rules that everyone knows, and that people know how to manipulate, and that people know how to use. I feel like, you know, like, for example, if you're assassinating someone, I find having a more crunchy way to do that is fun because, you know, then everyone knows what the rules are. No one is getting this random, like, they've been randomly assassinated because of this rules light narrative thing that happened that they weren't aware of. So I think those are the two big benefits of crunch, is that it allows people to enjoy that strategic side of thinking for people who really enjoy it. And it also allows you to kind of make sure that certain people have agency in the game and that they can, you know, they're always going to be able to take certain actions because they're codified in the rules and in the mechanics and in the mathematics of the game.
Mm.
I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I can see all that. I think I've learnt that I don't like crunch.
That's very reasonable.
I think I already knew it. I already knew that. But I'm not a big fan. I think I'm very wary of it, that like complexity and like complication of like the how complicated games are, crunch can creep into the design of games because the designer feels like it should be there for no other reason than because it should be. So I'm wary of it. I'm not a big fan of it. However, I totally agree that it is good. The positives of it is that it's there for certain people and you want to make sure that those people are having a good time. And I think that generally, from my experience anyway, running games here, there are usually a few people in the crowd who do want that. I think that it's also a bridge into the board game space, which I think is a double-edged sword because I don't want to create games, mega games, that people from board games come to and then they want, you know, they love it, but then they want a big board game every time because I don't want to design or run big board games every single time. So double-edged sword, but it does create an anchor that people from who only know board games can come in and understand what's some of the principles. I think the negatives of it is, in a similar sense, it can lock some people out, especially if there is not clear communication about what roles or game components are meant to achieve. And if there's not, for example, there's not casting or player casting in that they know exactly what the roles are about and they get to choose which one they would like, I think people can have a bad time easily if they end up in a place that has more crunch than they would like. And then I think broadly, design-wise, I think what I've learned is I'm more interested in giving a bit of complexity to people's decisions rather than adding crunch and heavy numbers and quantity of things. I would rather make difficult and complex decision-making built into the game where maybe there's only one decision someone has to make, but it has a lot of implications and a lot of connectors, rather than having a player who needs to make 20 decisions very quickly because it's sort of placing little cubes in different places, that kind of thing, and they need to weigh up the pluses and the minuses and all the different numbers. I think I would opt towards the prior, but arguably that is that can be a harder game to make, the one that it's more strategy and politics and implications and relationships between decisions.
Yeah, I completely, I think I am on your side about not really liking crunch. At least that's what, I mean, the design I'm working on now is very low crunch, and I definitely want to explore that space more. And I've seen how crunch can get out of control. I guess, I mean, look, another big takeaway I would say is that high crunch for a mega game is actually a super, super low bar. Like, you know, even a game that you, a board game that you think of and you're like, oh, this is a fun, you know, 20-minute party game, that is like a high crunch. If you put that in as a mega game section, that would probably be a reasonably crunchy mega game section just because of the way they are formatted and the time limits and everything like that. So I guess I guess with my designs, I feel like whatever design you're working on, it probably needs to be about half as crunchy as it is. Like,
yeah,
that's maybe a big exaggeration, but like, that's what I feel like. Like, mega games need to be pretty simple. And I think the crunch I that I really love is like emergent crunch of the decisions that are involved from a fairly low complexity rule set. Like in your mega game, Percy and the Iron Seas, it had the closed economy where, you know, nothing entered the game, there were no new resources, everything just went around in this interesting internal economy of merchants delivering spices and then other people trying to steal those things. Like, that's quite a crunchy system, but the actual actions, because if you're trying to figure out this economy, it's quite difficult, but the actual actions each player is taking is pretty simple. You know, you're stealing some money, you're taking some stuff, you're trading goods, like,
right.
Yeah, I feel like the things, that decision space crunch is kind of where you want to go for that style, I guess.
Yeah, and I think when you put it in that context, I think designs, because of the inherent size of a mega game, will always become complex to some degree. I think it's possible for them to be too light. I don't want to draw a line in the sand on that, but I think it's true. But I think just by creating a game that is quite light, once you add the complexity of 30, 40, 50, 100 players to it, it does up the complexity. It might not up the crunch necessarily, but it will make the game more complex and complicated for certain people because of the amount of decisions and relationships involved. So I agree with you that the bar is quite low because it happens almost inherently just through complexity of this big event. Well, awesome. I suppose the final thing I've learned is that maybe we should revisit this conversation with people who like crunch.
True. we agree on too many things. That's the problem with this podcast. Yeah. We need to get into more battles.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we could talk about lunch breaks.
Drama.
I think we've covered it, and if people are interested in weighing in and telling us why we're wrong or that we don't know enough about things, or you have interesting examples about crunch in design, we'd love to hear about it, so get in touch. But otherwise, I think we've nailed it again.
Yeah, this was a great conversation. It was really fun. Yeah, thanks so much everyone for listening.
Alrighty, till next time.